rules and regulations behind this. So Ernie's going to talk about specifically septic and what permits you might need. And then we're going to bring in Amy from the Lakewise program to understand that sometimes when you're on a lake or a riverfront, we're not just thinking about some of the permits involved in the septic, but also how that might impact what the health of the lakeshore and what permits are involved in that as well. So join me in welcoming Ernie.
Okay, the question that was asked by Sarah, the state adopted one set of rules, became effective September 29th of 2007, although the law was enacted for July 1st of 2007. And in that law, it said that a municipality could not have technical ordinances or technical standards we established. So I would need to know specifically what Grafton did that might be outside that technical standard and whether it existed prior to 2007. So the regional office program, Graham explained the glamorous portion of the program. I will explain the rules. We have 5 offices. 9 technical people, 5 administrative staff in the field, and then we have Christina Russo and Graham Bradley and me in the main office. The rules, the scope and the purpose. Okay, I'm done. I hope you enjoyed it. So while they're doing the technical, it's to protect human health and the environment. Basically, every set of rules, if you look at other states, those are the exact reasons that we exist. We have technical standards. We review all soil-based wastewater systems that are less than 6,500 gallons per day. The question about Long Point, they discharge more than 6,500, therefore they are under the indirect discharge program. We review all municipal connections and we review all municipal sewer collection systems. We review all potable water supplies, which are not public water supplies, and we review all municipal connections to public water systems. There are 2 towns that have delegation. Colchester was the first, Charlotte is the second. Those are the only 2 towns that administer our program on the local level. You can read what they can do, which is basically all that we do. So this audience is basically the residences. In the rules in section 301, we have 13 permit triggers. When do you need a permit? When you need to meet the technical standards and rules, which are subchapters 9, 10, 11, and 12. For single family residences, the most common triggers will be subdividing a lot, a new residence, adding a bedroom, which is increasing the design flow, converting from seasonal to year round, and adding an in-law apartment. Conversions from seasonal to year-round is if the camp was not occupied for 180 days in any calendar year between December 31st of 1986 and December 31st of 2006, it is considered a seasonal occupancy. We issue a permit because now we are expecting that residence to be occupied during the worst times of the year, which is generally April, May, February, and October, November, when the seasonal high water table is at its highest. And constructing a new wastewater system. exemptions for the residents, clean slate, which is kind of confusing, but whatever existed as of January 1, 2007 is considered clean slate. Construction of a wastewater system or water supply between January 1st of 07 and 6/30/07. Remembering that our rules did not become effective until, or universal jurisdiction did not exist until 6/30/07. Construction of a wastewater system or water supply serving a new residence, provided there's a designer certification, design and installation certification, that makes it considered a year-round resident. Constructing a new potable water supply does not include if you want to go to a surface water source. Legislature imposed on us a few years ago that certain water sources were acceptable for one single-family residence. It does require a well driller or a designer. We do have an exemption for. Another exemption that camps take, or single-family residents take advantage of, is they often will tear down their house, reconstruct, as long as it's done within 50 foot of the outside edge of the existing, and there's no increase in design flow and no improvements such as adding a pump station, dosing siphons, then it can be reconstructed. Converting to seasonal year-round needs a permit. Again, leach fields to function all seasons, during all seasons. The conversion may use the variances. You cannot use a holding tank. If your camp has a holding tank, you cannot convert to year-round. If there's a surface water, it needs to comply with the treatment requirements and the rules. This is new in the effective rules that are April 12, 2019. Converting from seasonal year-round, adding bedrooms. That is full compliance. That's an increase in the design flow. It needs to fully comply. You cannot use the variance section. Again, if the surface water needs to comply with the treatment requirements, and may not use a holding tank. Application requirements, it's kind of hard to see, but that's what your designer, Graham mentioned the designers in the room. They will prepare a plan for the design of the wastewater system, showing your house contours, your design flows. They will describe the soils and the plans. Surface water supplies require a professional engineer to design that water system. Most of this other aspect of this design can be done by, we have four classes of designers. We have the class ones, class A, B, and DW. And I would caution, if you're using the classes, class A's cannot design the site modifications. So they are not allowed to design mounds, bottom sand filters, situations like that. Potable water supply, Act 163. So if you're selling your camp, you're supposed to provide educational material on the benefits of testing the water supply. If you drill a new well, or you deepen a new well, or your existing well, the legislature imposed mandatory testing of all potable water supplies prior to use. Those test results will go to the Department of Health. And how do I find out if there is a permit? The permits, as Graham said, they run with the land. Permits for conversions or fails will have expiration dates. And Chris has been contacting a fair number of landowners who have not submitted their installation certifications to make sure that they are constructing their systems. You can do a search of our permits by going to that website. Find out if the old town permit exists by contacting the town or the regional engineer. Permits may include easements. Buyers need to know. Many lots have their wastewater systems on someone else's property. We did run into one situation where we approved the wastewater system on another property. It's now clean slated, but we found out that they never sold the property with the easement, and somebody built the house in their leach field area. So it's always good to check. Here's the link for our innovative and alternative approvals, treatments, dispersal type systems. Where do I find questions? This is kind of small print, but if you go to our webpage, there's a program, education, outreach, and resources, and Chris has put a lot of information on this website. Oh, this is nice. See, so you go to the department, the drinking water, the wastewater systems and potable water supplies, and the public outreach program. Information for landowners. That's on that page. Adding an accessory apartment. How do you do it? Brewery processing. A lot of you want to do home breweries. Remember, home breweries generate processing of beer has very high strength. And you want to be careful putting that in your leach field depending upon how much you want to brew. Do you need a permit? Do's and don'ts of your leach field and such. So this is all that you can go in and check. We have the link for the on-site loan program, the Shoreland Act. So we work closely with both programs. And where do I find answers to my questions? Your designer. They're intimate with the rules. General question, you can contact a permit specialist. There are four permit specialists around the state. One in each regional office except for St. Johnsbury, and that's covered by Pete out of the Montpelier office. You can contact your regional engineer. As I said, there's two in each office except for St. Johnsbury. St. Johnsbury only has one regional engineer. For compliance, you can contact Chris Russo. For IAs, Graham Bradley. You don't want to call him. So, questions? Well, thank you. All done? Great. Oh, yes?
So I have one from the webinar. And if, do you want me to just use the microphone?
It's a long question.
It's from Todd. So he had first asked, what's the future plan after the expected useful service life, refurbish, replace, and then he had a clarification on that. He said, now that he's addressing all types of system ownership, single family to community systems under 6,500 GPD design flows, what's the plan for those community systems discussed that have an expected 17-year service life?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure what Todd you mean by, I mean, systems are not intended. Some systems will fail very quickly if they're abused, some systems will last. We've approved mound systems, the current design for the mound since 1982, and we've never had a failure of some of those, or at least reported to us. So I'm not sure how to answer that question. Certainly if they have a problem, we will do under the variance section, as long as we have a design flow, we'll take care of that issue by constructing new systems. Certainly, everyone's gone through on the do's and don'ts to basically help extend the life of that system. I had a secretary who used to dump grease down her drain. That's not a good idea. So there are some common sense preventions you can do to help extend the life of the leach field. And if they don't and the system fails, we'll see them and we'll need to deal with it. I'm just not sure how to go beyond that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Ernie, living by the lake, one of the main kind of questions that comes up and problems I have with regulations is that concerning outdoor showers. It's kind of a long tradition, and it's certainly helpful to people who have holding tanks to not have shower. But our understanding of the regulations is that all outdoor showers have to be plumbed into the wastewater system of the house.
You really do want to, what? The question is, outdoor showers, do they need to be plumbed into the wastewater system? The basic answer is yes, they do. I mean, Graham and Amy will be talking about the runoff that could happen to the lakes, or you're on the bedrock, there are pathogens in it. We had this question though come up. The house I grew up in, it wasn't on the lakes, but it was on Little Peconic Bay on Long Island, and it had an outdoor shower. But that was when you're finished swimming, you just went and rinsed off the salt. That's different than somebody who puts in the shower and that's their sole means of showering. Then I think we need to look at that seriously.
I mean, they take the phosphorus out of the soap.
Right, but it's still the pathogens, and occasionally it's not a problem, but on a daily basis, yeah.
Great, thank you very
much. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Amy Peacott, and I work with the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources in the Lakes and Ponds program. And I'm delighted to be here this morning. I do recognize a lot of you. I'll be presenting today on shoreline management and lake-friendly practices through the talk on, along with regulations, a living shoreline is the best management practice for clean lakes. So what is a living shoreline? A living shoreline consists of these narragansetts. Kingfishers, lots of different birds, including our songbirds that feed and nest along our shorelines. A living shoreline provides a home habitat for lots of species of wildlife, like this family of otters. It also is made up of pollinator species. It attracts the insects as the pollinator species with the pollinator plants. And of course, a living shoreline supports our fisheries. Another very important component of the living shoreline are the native plants, like these aspens, white pine, the cherry trees, a mix of deciduous and conifer trees. Beautiful shrubs like these edible blueberries, some of our flowering viburnums, as well as our aquatic plants, like these blue flag iris, all make up a living shoreline. There's multiple benefits to a living shoreline, which will help filter and infiltrate stormwater runoff, protecting our water quality, also providing essential habitat both for wildlife and for people. Very few people would prefer a lake with fewer fish, no loons, murkier water, or worse, algae blooms. However, people, us humans, seem to do a really good job with clearing probably the most important component of a living shoreline, which are the native plants. So I'm going to get into a little more information on the importance of native plants, and then we'll come back around to the septic issue on the shoreline. So native plants are essential for healthy lake ecosystems. We know that there's many studies on this, but up to 40% of protein in our freshwater fish comes from terrestrial insects dropped from overhanging branches from native plants. We also know, thanks to the work of Dr. Douglas Talami, who is out of the University of Delaware. He started as an entomologist studying insects, but he's really become more of a botanist, an expert in native plants. We know that 96% of our birds depend entirely on insect protein to feed their young. So many of our birds might, as adults, be seed eaters or eat, they may be omnivores, but when they're raising their young, all these birds, 96%, depend on finding, for the most part, the larval stage of butterflies and moth, the Lepidoptera caterpillars, because they're soft and gooey. And they also have a high amount of carotenoid, which they're finding more science out about why that is so important to birds, but it is the baby bird food that's so essential. We also sadly know that 40% of our songbirds are decreasing right across the country because of starvation and a lack of the native plants playing host to insects, to the native insects. So this guy, I sort of considered Dr. Doug Talami as the terrestrial scientist of today, equivalent to the Jacques Cousteau of the ocean conservation movement. He has published, oh gosh, I don't know, you know, hundreds of studies and written many books, sort of a prodigy of some of you may know, have heard of E.O. Wilson, who is from Harvard University. I think he's now 95. He started the Earth, Half Earth Project, but also an entomologist. So what Doug Talami has found out is that insects have co-evolved with one or two host native plants. So some of you may be familiar with the relationship between the monarch butterfly and the milkweed plant. And when there's no milkweed, there's no monarch. It cannot survive without that specific host plant. Well, that actually holds true for over 90% of our other plant-eating insects. So, for example, if you've seen a Luna moth, one of those bright green neon moths, there would have to be a shagbark hickory nearby, because that is its host plant. The Luna moth actually, I think it has one other host plant as well, but without the shagbark hickory, there won't be any Luna moth. So, thanks to this research, we know, for example, the black cherry tree, many of us are familiar with that tree in Vermont. It has been sort of coined the supermarket plant for wildlife. But it plays host to 456 insects. So when you cut down and remove a cherry tree along the shore, in your backyard, anywhere, you've taken away the host plant for 456 insects. The oak tree, remarkably, has 534 insects that depend on that tree alone. So if you want to plant any tree this spring, plant an oak, plant a cherry, plant a willow, plant a birch, one of these that support many, many insects and a source of protein for our songbirds and the rest of our wildlife. I've read studies that bears, 30% of their protein comes from insects. Well, the insects aren't going to be there if we don't have the native plants to support them. So average chickadee, when it's rearing its young does about 146 trips back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, just to bring enough larvae to feed a nest of 3 to 5 young chickadees in a day. That's a lot of work. They're smart. They don't just go and get one larva at a time. They also, they often bring back 3 or 4 at a time to save some of their energy. But if those host plants aren't there, they cannot feed their brood. Okay, so the benefits of native plants. Again, there's so many of them, but they provide food and habitat for wildlife. They provide shade for aquatic animals. They cool the water to hold more dissolved oxygen for fish. They limit aquatic plant growth. They benefit water quality. They stabilize banks and prevent erosion, infiltrate and filter upland runoff. Benefit property owners, build resiliency along the shore against storm damage. Let nature do the work for you. Protect your bank. There's a slogan, you can put green on your bank. Put green in your bank, whatever. Protect your own property investments. And actually, plants make us smart. It's true. Now we get to go on a little journey here, a little bit away from the theme of this conference, but we'll come back. So there's lots of research on this today, how spending time out and around wild natural spaces can increase our productivity by 6%, 15% more creativity, 15% higher level of well-being. And you know who knows this? Apple, Google, Facebook, Samsung, YouTube, and Airbnb know this. They're building their campuses with these wild spaces to maximize these benefits to their employees. Here's what Google has done, taking an urban stream and restored it to this natural wild riparian area just to reap these benefits. Not thinking so much about stormwater management, although that's clearly a huge side benefit for water quality, but they're just doing it for us as humans alone, restoring with native plantings. And there's a new, some of you may have heard of this, Duncan Murdoch. He offers forest bathing workshops out of Shelburne as a therapeutic way to heal. And it's not necessarily new. In Japan, since the middle of 1980s, doctors have been writing prescriptions for 30 minutes a day, go out in a wild place, go out in nature, and improve your well-being, your emotional and physical well-being. So there's many multiple benefits to protecting and restoring these native plantings and wild spaces. However, over the last 30 to 50 years, we did a really good job of clearing the native vegetation along our shorelands and putting our houses as close to the water's edge as possible. And it wasn't such a big deal when it was just one or two camps. But what's happened now is we have cleared entire lake shores and developed what turns out to be the highest residential density in Vermont. 5% of Vermonters live along lake shores, and the residential density is 2.5 times higher than anywhere else, higher than downtown Burlington, higher than downtown Rutland, right around our lake shores. And it also turned out that Eric Howe, who presented this morning, was part of this study back in 2007 with Kelly Merrill, Neil Cannon, Mark Mitchell, and Leslie Matthews all contributed to this, that we did such a good job of clearing that we ended up ranking worse than the nation in degraded shallow water habitat. We're from the green state, right? No one could believe this, but that's what happened. And we also found out from the National Lake Assessment Study that unlike Lake Champlain, which 55% of the state drains to, has a lot of tributary loading going on, but unlike Lake Champlain, we have 800 other lakes in Vermont, that the greatest threat to those lakes isn't phosphorus, it's actually from clearing the shores and destroying the habitat. So by 2014, we've passed in Vermont the Shoreland Protection Act, which gives the state jurisdiction on all lakes 10 acres or greater, which is about 445 lakes out of the 800, from the water's edge, the mean water level, back 250 feet, to review changes in development or new development. So what would trigger a permit is if you do clear vegetation or increase your impervious surface area. Those are the two triggers for a permit. Any new impervious surface area creation, like a deck, a driveway, an expansion on a camp, those hard surfaces that don't let the rain infiltrate into the ground but shed the water, that's impervious surface. Whether you're a paved driveway or a gravel, that would be compacted and considered impervious. And then clearing. So all the trees and vegetations from the water's edge back 250 feet are now protected. There's some exceptions. If it's an invasive species, you can clear it. If you have an existing developed lot and you always have had a landscape maintenance plan going on for years and years and years, you're allowed to continue that. You would have been grandfathered in before the 2014 Shoreland Protection Act. There's additional components to the act, and basically I sort of remember these as 100, 20, 20, 40. So for an undeveloped lot now, you need to set your camp back 100 feet. It actually turns out that you really need to build 125 feet back, because the first 100 feet of vegetation is now protected and preserved. So you can't disturb that, and you can't go into it as a work zone. So you have to start your work back 100 feet. This is for undeveloped lots. And if your slope is greater than 20%, you're going to be required to do some additional, what we call BMPs, best management practices, to offset the increase in runoff from the slope. And for impervious surface, if you have a small parcel and your plan is to go beyond 20% impervious surface, you're going to be required to offset the runoff with these BMPs, best management practices, like a rain garden, infiltration trenches, things like that, because we don't want that runoff going right directly into the lake. And then if you clear more than 40%, once again, these BMPs would apply through the act. However, most of our, as you can imagine, our bigger, larger, more desirable kind of lakefront properties have already been developed before 2014. And they've highly been cleared, often more than 40%. And they have a great amount of impervious surface that exceeds the 20%. So those properties, a lot of what goes on those properties may never come through the permit program. They're already grandfathered there. I mean, if they still would need, if they're going to put an expansion on the camp, to check with a permit specialist to see if they need a permit. But that leaves about 55% of our shoreline that is undeveloped. So the act is still really helpful and it's really well timed. But in that undeveloped shoreline, we'll always be going through the permit program. So for the existing developed shore, we, in addition to the Shoreland Protection Act, we have what we call the Lakewise Program. And this is a sort of a shoreland incentive program to encourage shoreland owners to incorporate BMPs to manage their stormwater runoff, protect water quality, and to revegetate using native plantings, whether they're putting it in a vegetated swale, or a reestablishing a shoreline or a rain garden. So, and they get these beautiful Lakewise Award signs that is designed by a Vermont artist to showcase what exemplary shoreline management looks like and to teach their neighbors. And these are examples of the shoreline best management practices. There's vegetative ones that infiltrate, filter, and benefit wildlife. And then there's a lot of structural ones, like open top culvert water bars or infiltration steps. And these are the same ones that the Shoreline Protection Act would use, as well as the Lakewise program. There's a Federation of Vermont Lakes and Ponds did some of the first shoreline BMPs in the state. Loved this little project, compacted area behind this camp, threatened the camp, but also made its way along the edges of Harvey's Lake, put in a lot of nice native vegetation infiltration steps. And then finally, we have these septic socials. I thought Graham may alluded to this early, but he's done a great job in the last 2 years being on call for these. This one's up at Echo Lake, where we gather on the lakeshore and we actually go through the system. Jared Willie has shown up last year all the way to Lake Maury. This is a raised sand filter. There's Jared at the end. They're explaining to everybody how this works, which we will hear more about later this afternoon. But these are really neat alternative systems for smaller, tighter spots. The other thing we do through our outreach program for shoreline management is we offer every November the Natural Shoreline Erosion Control Certification Program. And some of you I know, I recognize, have been through this. And we get into a little more depth on the shoreline BMPs and bioengineering and different products that are more lake friendly in terms of erosion control, biodegradable products, that kind of stuff. But we have a listing of all the folks that have been through the program available through our website. And then this is just an example of some of the things we do mention and cover more through the Natural Shoreline Erosion Control Certification class. This is restoring a shore down on Bombsey Lake. I just want to